Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current. This is Thursday, which means this is Mail Day. Time to read your thoughts on what you've been hearing on The Current over the last week. And here to help me is our Friday host, Pia Chattopadhyay, and she is with me in Toronto. Good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
We've got so much to get through. I guess we should just begin, huh?
Okay.
We begin with a story that really struck a chord with a lot of our listeners. Monday on The Current, we brought you Sharon Peterson's story. In the mid-60s, she was 19 years old, single and pregnant. Ostracized by her family, she was sent to live with relatives in Victoria, BC. She was thrown into a social welfare system that didn't care that she wanted to keep her baby. She described what happened when she met her social worker a few weeks after the birth.
I cried, of course. I cried. I begged. I screamed. I kicked. I threw furniture. And this fighting went on for quite a bit. I'd screaming and I called them names and I just, everything. I tried so hard, and then they threatened to call the police. And I thought, why are you calling the police? I just want my baby. And so I sighed.
It doesn't get any easier to listen to. That is from the documentary Motherhood Interrupted. It was produced by The Current's Kathleen Goldhar. And after it aired, we received an outpouring of mail and phone calls. This is some of what we got on the voicemail.
My name is Mary McDonald. I live in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Having been adopted as an infant in Charlottetown PEI back in the late 1950s, we need to be clear that these unmarried mothers were coerced into giving up their babies. By the time the victims catch up with these people who were involved in these terrible practices, they're beyond reach to be held accountable. This is another layer of the whole injustice of it all.
My name is Janet McGowan, Sherwood Park, Alberta. I had my daughter in 1968. The difference between the lady who was on and myself was my family did support me. I took my baby home with me, but I was pressured every day that I was in the hospital, and I was in for about 5 or 6 days by social workers wanting me to give my baby up for adoption. The worst part about it was, even though I knew the name of the father, even though the father said he was the father of the baby, I was not allowed to put the father's name on the birth certificate, and I find that absolutely horrific.
That last call was from Janet McGowan of Sherwood Park, Alberta. And clearly, this is a story that resonated with a lot of you and raised a lot of questions. So to help us answer some of those questions, we're joined now by Kathleen Goldhar, who produced the documentary. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Pia. Hi, Anna Maria.
Kathleen, Sharon's story hit home with a whole bunch of people, huh?
It sure did. The problem is that Sharon's story actually isn't that unique. Certainly before I got to meet Sharon, I spoke to a lot of other women who had the same story. And then after the story aired, we heard from a lot more women who were forced to give up their baby because they were young and unmarried. Here's an example from Kara Lazar of Prince George, British Columbia, who writes, "Sharon's story enraged me and broke my heart. It made me so grateful to realize how far we have come and what freedoms we now have as women. Now we can have our babies or not, but it's finally up to us. Sharon and other girls like her had such shame put on them by other people. Damn those who threw stones as if they had never made a mistake. And damn the men who had sex with them, and then it was fine for them."
That comes from Kara Lazar of Prince George, BC.
Kathleen, that letter brings up the father of Sharon's baby, and in the documentary, Sharon talks about how much she loved him. But we didn't hear anything else about what happened. Do you know more about that part of the story?
I do. She told me a lot about the man who was her daughter's father. She believed that he loved her as much as she loved him. Unfortunately, his family wasn't particularly supportive of their relationship because she wasn't Italian and he was. But that if they had been given the chance, they would have raised their baby together. Sharon also believes that he wasn't told the truth. And actually, I called him just before the documentary was going to air, and he told me that all he remembers is that Sharon up and left town. And that all he was told was that she didn't want to keep the baby. And now we know that wasn't the case.
Wow, so many terrible stories and different stories. Here is another letter from Anne Patterson of London, Ontario, who writes, I too was captured for the adoption farm. My mother did not want to surrender me, nor did my father. Children's Aid did not provide them with legal avenues and information. Unmarried mothers had access to financial help, but Children's Aid and Child Welfare didn't disclose information. Because of errors and omissions, women were left with no choice. These adoptions are not legal the way they were carried out. We need an inquiry, not only to validate the experiences of these mothers and their now adult offspring, but to prevent unaccountable brokers from further exploiting people for financial gain.
Kathleen, Anne Patterson in that letter brings up, she says, the need for an inquiry. Definitely she wants one. And as we said on Monday, there are now calls for an inquiry. What's happening on that front?
Well, there are certainly still calls. And there, you know, a few groups formed over the years, and they're now asking the federal government to look into it. And there is some support from MPs and some members of provincial parliament, but that's as far as it's got. I do know that since speaking to me, Sharon has called a lawyer and is looking into if there's any legal avenues for her case. In Australia, they've actually already held the first ever federal inquiry into forced adoption, and a report is actually expected at the end of November. And the group that pushed for that inquiry told me that they've uncovered evidence of unlawful practices by Canadian and American social workers there. And then I did just speak to a lawyer here who says that he's about to launch a bunch of class action suits across the country. And because this would fall under provincial jurisdiction, the suits are going to be launched in every province.
So in the Canadian context, what will the class action suits be saying?
They're claiming four things. And the first is maybe going to surprise you, but they're claiming that they were victims of genocide. So under Article 2E of the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, it says that an aspect of genocide is to forcibly transfer children from one group to another group. So what they're claiming is that the children of white unmarried mothers here were illegally transferred to other people. So that's the first thing. They're also claiming battery. So the difference between assault and battery is that assault is when you touch somebody else in anger. Battery goes beyond that. And their battery claims center around that they were given medical treatment during their pregnancy and delivery beyond their consent and knowledge. Thirdly, they're claiming kidnapping and then fraud. Many of these mothers were told that they had to get special permission to get welfare, which isn't true. And we heard that in a past letter. Some of these mothers were told that their babies had died. Other mothers who asked about getting their kids back were just basically told they weren't allowed to have them back.
Do we have any idea how many young women were forced to give up their children here in Canada?
Well, it's hard to know, but there's a group called Origins Canada, which is a group that helps women who have had their children forcibly removed from them. And they told me that it is easily more than 400,000 women in Canada between the years of 1945 and 1975 that were coerced or forced to give up their children. But it goes beyond that, because I heard from mothers who told me they were forced to give up their children in the mid-1980s.
As recent as that?
As recent as that. And there's another important point, one that goes beyond pushing for an inquest, that many of them say go to the real heart of this issue. The majority of the women who had their babies forcibly removed were white. And the infertile couples looking for babies, they were white. So those affected say that they were targeted because they were white.
You know, all of this reminds me of the story that came out in the 90s of the Butterbox Babies. It was a book written by a former CBC producer, Betty Cahill, The Ideal Maternity Home in Eastchester, Nova Scotia, where in the late 20s to the late 40s, it was a source of babies for an illegal trade in infants between Canada and the U.S., and they would tell unmarried mothers, but sometimes even couples who had gone there for the birth of a baby, that the baby had died and that it was buried in a little butter box. And of course, and when they opened them up years later, there was nothing there. Or they starved unmarketable quote unquote babies to death and buried them. But this was like an illegal trade that it was uncovered years, decades later.
Unfortunately, there's a long history of that kind of thing in Canada and beyond.
You know, Kathleen, I guess at the end of the day, what I wonder is how could this have happened to so many young women?
Well, there's really a bunch of factors, like anything that's complicated. So private adoptions were legal in Canada then. So a doctor could arrange an adoption between his own clients. So he had an infertile couple who, unlike today, didn't have any access to fertility treatments. And then the doctor knows of this couple who can't have any kids and wanted them, and he also knows of a young, unmarried, pregnant girl in his practice, and he sees a business opportunity. Then add into the mix maternity homes run by churches, usually, who kept the girls hidden, and hospitals that worked with social workers who believed that these girls couldn't and shouldn't be allowed to keep their kids. Over and over again, I heard from women who said nurses, especially, treated these girls like animals. And then you throw in society, who believed that these girls, again, couldn't and shouldn't be allowed to keep their kids. There was the overarching belief that these girls, these mothers, just needed to get over it. One woman told me that she was told by her social worker to think of it like a pet dog who got hit by a car. It's sad, you'll cry, but you'll get over it, and you can really get another dog. Over and over again, I heard from women who said that they felt like they were tortured, both while in the maternity homes and in the hospital. And while the details of every story is, of course, different, what they all told me is that this ruined their lives.
Hmm. You're talking about so many women. What about the children these women were forced to give up? Did you hear about the impact this might have on lives? How would you even know if you were one of those kids?
Those who have their own children did tend to tell their families about this. So the kids tended to know. And a lot of the women that I spoke to did eventually reconnect with the children that they lost, just like Sharon had. But just like Sharon told me that these reunions, they're complicated. There's still a lot of grief. There's still so much loss. Some people that I spoke to, you know, managed to kind of get through this, have a strong, lasting relationship, just like Sharon does with her daughter. But others told me that really that just became too stressful and their communication just eventually ended because both sides just couldn't deal with the reality of the situation.
Mm. We actually also got letters from their children, grown women now, but who had been forcibly taken from their mothers as babies, including this letter from Karen Logan of Nelson, British Columbia. She wrote, "Hearing Sharon's story made me want to call my birth mother just to tell her how much I love her. Of course, I have forgiven her, as it really wasn't her fault. She was actually lied to and deceived by the social workers again and again, and because she was only 19 and didn't know any better, she believed them. She tried to keep me, and I was put in a foster home until I was 15 months, when I was finally adopted. She doesn't even remember ever signing any papers to allow them to do so. She even fought for me in court to try to get me back."
You know, the effects that these events had on these women, it's obvious. But it also had such a significant impact on their families. I spoke to a woman named Laura Anderson from Victoria, British Columbia. And she told me that her mother, who died 8 years ago, had been forced to give up a daughter before Laura was born.
"I'm 50 now, and it's taken 25 years of thinking about this to understand that my mom was really affected on levels that I didn't originally see. She was a functioning alcoholic, so she was managing her life, but she drank pretty much every day and sometimes excessively. Our relationship was really affected because there were certain things that she could not see about me or engage in with me emotionally. There was sexual abuse going on in my family, and she was unable to acknowledge that it was happening. Now I understand that that was connected to certain emotional distance that she had to keep within herself in order to just survive."
You know, it's incredible the lengths people went to cope and to deal, and the various outcomes. As you say, every situation was different. I'm wondering, though, Kathleen, there are the couples who ended up adopting these children, and that seems like another complicated aspect to this entire story.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to imagine that these couples thought they were adopting these children in good faith. And we did hear from one of those women this week as well. Nova Moffitt, who lives in Thornhill, Ontario, shares a different perspective with us. She writes, "What was the intention of airing this documentary? I have two children who were adopted at 2 and 3 months of age. We adopted them in 1967 and 1969. One mother was 16, the other mother 19, and it was her second child. I understand this woman's pain. Losing a child is a great loss. Her treatment by everyone was very harsh. I have had to bear the fact that I could not have my own children, but luckily was able to adopt two beautiful children. My daughter died in 2005 in a car accident. I have been able to move on, but there are difficult times. My advice is to learn how to grieve with help if necessary."
Well, that letter comes from Nova Moffitt of Thornhill, Ontario. Kathleen Goldhar, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Current's Kathleen Goldhar produced the documentary Motherhood Interrupted that we aired on Monday. Next up in the mail, erotic capital. Not often that you hear those words on the CBC, but last Thursday on The Current, we heard an argument for dolling up at the office to get ahead. Catherine Hackim is the author of Erotic Capital, The Power of Attraction in the Boardroom and the Bedroom, and she believes an attractive appearance is a bankable commodity.
We've been told for so long by patriarchal ideology, we've been brainwashed into thinking that beauty is superficial, it's only skin deep, it's trivial, it's futile, it's really beneath us to rely in any way on this. And so we have to break that attitude and recognize that it has genuine social and economic value. There is this stream that has been anti-femininity, anti-beauty, anti-elegance, I would say even. That has put some women off feminism, which is great pity.
Catherine Hackim is a sociologist at the London School of Economics and the author of Erotic Capital, The Power of Attraction in the Boardroom and the Bedroom.
And a lot of you had a lot to say about her argument. First to Nolan Sontag of Calgary, who writes, Catherine Hackim was over-sexualizing the concept of appearance in the workplace. Her point is not a new one. People who maintain an ideal appearance in the workplace will likely benefit from that practice career-wise. However, such benefits stem more from matching social ideals than exploiting one's sexual appeal. People don't think you're good at your job because they find you sexy. They assume you're good at your job because you're good at looking good. Looking good is the same as being sexy, only in certain social contexts. Whether or not the workplace is one of these contexts is debatable.
That comes from Nolan Sontag of Calgary, and Elliot Albright of Montreal had this to say. As a self-described dandy and charmer, who also happens to be a woman with somewhat masculine sensibilities, I don't believe this is an issue of femininity. Men are great at leveraging charm and social skills to get ahead. Women just have to learn to do this while not giving people, especially men in powerful positions, the wrong idea. It's worth considering how one might do this. I find a sense of humor and a sharp suit work wonders.
That comes from Elliot Albright of Montreal. And here's one more email. This one comes from Jessica Reardon-Smith of Hamilton, Ontario. She writes, to present this idea as just another area that can be worked on, like education, misses the underlying issues around a society that will pay more to someone for being attractive. Doesn't Ms. Hackim see a problem with such a wide gap between people, especially since there are physical, economic, and social limits to the erotic capital someone can display? Instead of encouraging people to focus on these skills, we should be discussing the implications of this inequality.
That comes from Jessica Reardon-Smith of Hamilton. And here are a couple of more thoughts from our voicemail.
Your guest is saying that having social skills are erotic capital. Seems sexual attractiveness is not necessarily part of erotic capital. But what does erotic mean then? It definitely has a sexual connotation.
Marianne Michelak, Montreal. I'm an attractive woman who has modeled, been in the business world, flown to represent companies. I really agree with Susan G. Cole. I'm now 55. Still have men hitting on me younger and older. I have women jealous of me because of my attractiveness. It would be nice if we can get on with the job without all this erotica that Catherine Hackim was talking about. Let her walk miles and miles in a woman's shoes who is considered better than average looking. It has been a long, hard climb for me to get to where I got in the corporate world.
Well, that's all we have on the neurotica over erotica and capital today. That last call from Marianne Michelak of Montreal.
Okay, now we have an update on a story we aired earlier on The Current. In June, the CBC's Carol McDowell brought us the story of the Von Palesk family. Every day for 25 years, Wolfgang Von Palesk would come home from work, throw open his arms, and greet his wife and children with a big hug. He worked at an asbestos manufacturing plant near Toronto. But what he didn't know was that every day he came home with little bits of chrysotile asbestos clinging to his clothes. And every time he hugged his family, he was exposing them to the substance that ultimately led to his premature death. He died of mesothelioma, a rare form of cancer usually caused by asbestos exposure.
I envy people who talk about their parents dying peacefully in their sleep. My dad woke up for it. And it wasn't painless. His chest rattled and he gasped. For months later, I'd wake up and I'd see that face. And I can't shake that pained face. And now my mom has this. And she wanted so much for my dad not to work at this place. He had to bring home a paycheck. But he was bringing home a deadly killer with that paycheck. We all breathed it in.
That is Heidi Von Palesk from a documentary that aired in June on The Current. Her father died of mesothelioma from exposure to asbestos. And as you heard there, Heidi's mother was diagnosed with the very same thing. Since we aired that documentary, Heidi's mother has died of the disease. Of course, asbestos is now a mineral restricted in Canada, but still mined in Quebec and exported to developing regions like India. Earlier this month, we got an email from Heidi Von Palesk. She wrote to tell us that just 4 days before her mother died, she asked Heidi to record her dying plea to the asbestos industry and to our political leaders. This is part of that video, a conversation between Heidi Von Palesk and her dying mother.
What do you think of the fact that they've just spent millions and millions of dollars taking asbestos out of apartment buildings while they're defending internationally the right to sell asbestos?
Well, it isn't just the apartment buildings. They're doing it in schools, they're doing it in other government buildings. I know when I was working in Oshawa, these buildings there of asbestos that were holding government employees. So they know that it's wrong, but they still want to sell it. Because the government is money hungry. How they can do that? No, it's a crime. And when I said it's murderous, it is. Because it's not just affecting workers. It's affecting the wives, the mothers, the babies, the children of all ages. Everybody is not immune to this. If they think they are certainly in the pits of ignorance.
I just read in the paper about a family. Father worked in Jones Handle. Died of mesothelioma. Mother died of mesothelioma.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, this young man watched his brother and sister die of mesothelioma, and at 48, he's just been diagnosed in April and given 6 months to a year. Any reaction to that?
It's heartbreaking. It truly is. I have children. I worry about them because their father would pick them up when he'd come home from work. He had the crystalline asbestos all over his clothes. We didn't know that they could be breathing it in. And we're waiting for results of some of the tests that they're having. And I pray to God that all the tests are negative. I think it's so sad. So sad to see this happen to them because there's no help for the ones that have gone too far. There's no help for us. We have to just lay here day after day, waiting for the end to come. And my children have to suffer seeing me like this, because this is not the real me. I used to be a very lively person. Now I have lost my independence. I've lost my spirit.
Do 55,000 Indians and their family deserve this because they're poor?
Oh, God, no. They have enough to put up with without this added to the other problems. Yeah, the country sure has pollution. So do we, but this is something beyond that. Much beyond it. And it's far spread in these poor countries. What do they gain? Ignorance. Nobody tells them. They don't know. They don't know. And if they did, what can they do about it? Because governments hide it. They hide it because there's money involved.
If Stephen Harper were here right now, what would you say to him?
I'm afraid it would be very kind. I would say, would he like his children to go through this, or his wife, or himself? No, he wouldn't, because he protects himself. But he doesn't protect his people or anybody else. They talk about being humanitarian. This man is not in that category at all. As I said before, they are, to me anyway, potential murderers. They know what's happening, and they don't stop it. He's as guilty as any murderer that goes out and knows they're going to kill somebody. That's what I think, Mr. Harper. He hides behind whatever is a humanitarian. He's not. I'm afraid as long as governments keep hiding behind closed doors, dear, there won't be any hope. They have to admit it, first of all, and then stop it. It stopped the mines from working. They can find other jobs for these people. They don't have to say, well, it's their bread and butter. It isn't their bread and butter.
Well, that is from a videotaped conversation between Heidi Von Palask and her mother, recorded just 4 days before her mother's death.
Also last month, hundreds of healthcare professionals signed an open letter to Conservative MP Dr. Kelly Leach, a prominent pediatric orthopedic surgeon, urging her to honour her medical oath and not support the Harper government's ongoing efforts to defend Canada's controversial asbestos exports. And one final note on this story, a walk to remember victims of asbestos will be taking place next month on October the 1st in Sarnia, Ontario.
That is it for the mail today, but to share your thoughts about anything you hear on the program, email us from our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent. You can call us toll-free whenever you want at 1-877-287-7366. Find us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for The Current CBC Radio, or write us via Canada Post, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Pia Chattopadhyay. What are you doing on The Current tomorrow?
Okay, I love heist movies, especially like movies about art heists and stuff. And so I think, like most people, I have this sort of mythological idea of what it's like based on the Hollywood versions. Well, we are going
to... It's very glamorous. When they rob.
And they wear tuxedos and things, and women wear cat suits. Okay, so we're going to pop the bubble a bit tomorrow on The Current. We're talking about a new book called Hot Art, and it takes us into the reality of the world of stolen art. It is intriguing and as fascinating as all those Hollywood movies make it out to be, but maybe just the accuracy of the Hollywood versions isn't just there.
Oh, say it isn't so.
Oh, it isn't so.
Okay, I'll be listening. Pia Chattopadhyay, thank you.
Okay.
Pia Chattopadhyay, the Friday host of The Current this week. Stay with us. Q is next on CBC Radio 1. Tonight at 10 o'clock, CBC Television. Watch The National with Peter Mansbridge. He has the At Issue panel tonight. Andrew Coyne, Chantal Hebert, and Bruce Anderson weigh in with their thoughts of the week in politics. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening to The Current.